right about now, I would like to bring on somebody for you. Want to tell you that, ask you to help me make this introduction. I'd like to say a name, and I'd like you to repeat the name. And then when we get through, we'll all add it up, and it ought to have some fun for you. Are you ready? Let me say it first. You repeat it after me. John.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, a history of the Beatle years, 1962 to 1970. I'm Roger Scott in London.
Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody. This is Paul speaking.
Over to John.
Over to George, I forgot.
Okay, I'll over to George.
John speaking.
Hello.
That was Ringo, folks.
What can I say?
And goodbye to all of us.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely.
Now, this is one we used to do at the Cavern with the Beatles, and we used to have little groups of fans who used to give themselves little names. There used to be a group of fans called the Cement Mixers, with some other group called the Wooden Tops. And they just make up little names for themselves, you know, being a little gang. And there was two girls called Chris and Val, and they used to sing Searching, Paul. That used to be the big request from Chris and Val, sing Searching. So we always used to do this one. It used to be a big request, and it was a big favourite with the group.
Gonna find her. Gonna find her.
Well,
searching.
Yeah,
searching.
Now,
searching
everywhere to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh Lord, I got
searching.
My goodness,
searching.
Yeah, 'cause I'm searching.
Oh, I'm
searching. Oh, my goodness,
searching.
We're into
it. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm like a
northwest
mountain. You know I'll bring her some.
Thank you.
Searching, one of the 15 songs recorded at the most famous failed audition in history. The date was January the 1st, 1962, at the place Decca Studios, West Hampstead, London. But the Beatles didn't learn that they'd failed the audition until March. Groups of guitars were on the way out, they were told. Not in Liverpool. On January the 4th, they were voted the top group on Merseyside by the readers of the Merseybeat newspaper. And the following day saw the UK release of a song recorded the previous year in Hamburg with singer Tony Sheridan and the Beatles, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Pete Best and Stuart Sutcliffe. And if it hadn't have been for that record, they would never have met the man who was to become their manager, Brian Epstein.
I started whilst I was in charge of the records division of a family concern of which I was and am, as Pat was still a director. We were asked, or I was asked, by a young boy for a record by a group by the Beatles. And it always had been our policy in records to look after whatever request was made. And I followed up this inquiry. I didn't know anything about it. And it was only after a week or two that he told me that they were, in fact, a Liverpool group. I assumed, for some reason, that they were from Germany. Anyway, he told me that they were a Liverpool group and that they'd just, in fact, returned from Germany and that they were playing in a club called The Cavern, about 100 yards away from my office. And I arranged to go down there and I saw them one midday session, which is a pretty... And at the time, it was a pretty much of an eye-opener to go down into this darkened, dank, smoky cellar in the middle of the day and to see crowds and crowds of kids watching these four young men on stage. They were sort of rather scruffily dressed in the nicest possible way, or I should say in the most attractive way. Black leather jackets and jeans. Long hair, of course, and rather untidy stage presentation, not terribly aware and not caring very much what they looked like.
Mine is by Dindu, my darling. Mine is fanned by Dindu, there's glue. Noch trend
Bonnie, Tony Sheridan and the Beatles. Brian Epstein officially became their manager on January the 24th, 1962.
Actually, the first meeting that we had, the first business meeting we had, we held at my store. It got off to a very late start. It was quite amusing, really. Three of the boys arrived at the appointed time at 4 o'clock. I was very busy ordering records for Christmas. And Paul didn't show at all for at least three quarters of an hour. And I was a bit put out about this. I thought this is the first meeting. They want to do something about management and so on. And I asked one of the boys to get on the phone to him. And he came back and he said, well, he's just got up. He's in the bath. So I sort of, you know, shouted about a bit. And I thought, this is very disgraceful indeed. And how can he be so late for an important thing? And George just simply replied, it was very typical of them, well, he may be late, but he's very clean.
In 1962, most of the Beatles' repertoire consisted of cover versions of American rock and roll and R&B songs, even though Paul and John were both writing originals at the time. Coming up next, you'll hear a 1962 Beatles rehearsal recording of a song they wouldn't officially record until 1969 for the Let It Be album. Now listen to a Beatles rehearsal recorded in 1962 of the song One After 909, a song they would eventually release on the Let It Be album.
You're traveling on the one after 909. Said, move over, honey, I'm traveling on that line. I said, move over once, move over twice. Come on, baby, don't be cold as ice. Says you're traveling on the one after 909. Beg her not to leave, and I beg her on my belly.
The number.
McCartney remembers those early originals.
Because I really never thought of that. Just played the first one of the first songs we'd ever done.
Right, it was John the Raisin, he was 15 or something.
Yeah. It's just we all used to sag off every school day, you know. Yeah. Go back to my house and the two of us would just sort of sit there and write, Love Me Do, and Too Bad About Sorrows. And there's a lot from then, you know. There's about 100 songs from then that we never reckoned. Because they were all very unsophisticated songs. They said our love was just fun the day that our friendship begun.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no blue moon that I can see. There's never been in history. But, you know, and we thought, it's too much. But it's great. Yeah, they're great. And that one, we always hated the words of One After 9-0-9. Every since the child, One After 9-0-9. He said, move on, honey, I'm travelling on that line. He says, move on once, move on twice. Come on, baby, don't be cold sides.
Said you're travelling on the One After 9-0. Said you're travelling on the One After 9-0. Said you're travelling on the One After 9-0.
Also on that 1962 rehearsal tape is another original that they would never record. It was an instrumental, and later on in the 60s, a British jazz band would record the song called Cat Call. But in 1962, it was called Cat's Walk. Here it is. Their rejection by Decca Records, Brian Epstein had been trying to secure a recording contract for the Beatles at other major British labels, only to be turned down by them all, until a recording of the original Decca audition was brought to the attention of George Martin at Parlophone Records.
At that time I was head of Parlophone Records in England, and it was a comparatively small and not really important label, and consequently, although I rejoiced in the title of being the chief man, I was also the chief cook and bottle washer, did all the recording of all sorts. And I was looking for something, I was looking for new artists, and I put the word around amongst the business. And I had a call from Sid Coleman, who was the EMI public music publisher, who worked in HMV's shop in Oxford Street. And the engineer in the shop had heard a tape that was brought in by someone, and brought it to Sid Coleman's notice, and Sid suggested that I should listen to it, and sent the gentleman who produced the tape along to see me. And that was Brian Epstein. So I made an appointment to see Brian, and he brought me a disc of the tape that he had cut in the Oxford Street shop, and played me some of the songs. And he was quite a nice chap, and I listened to the material, which wasn't very interesting. Rather scruffy, in fact. But there was something about them, about the sound, that I thought was interesting, and I told Brian that I would deign to give the group a test, which was the normal procedure in those days. That meant I would devote a morning or an afternoon in the studios to the particular group in question and listen to them. And inwardly, he must have groaned, because he was going through the same process he'd been through many times before. So he brought the Beatles down from Liverpool, and I think it was April or May, I think it was April 1962, that I first heard them in the studio, which was rather a different affair to listening to that initial tape. It was John, George, and Paul, and Pete Best. So the very first time I heard them in the studio, it was like that too. And Pete Best was the one who sat in the drums in the corner, not saying really much. And he was also the most good-looking of the lot, I thought, at the time. He had the kind of sultry James Dean look about him, which was very popular at that time. But nevertheless, he didn't really fit in with the rest of them. He wasn't a particularly good drummer.
Each time I look into your eyes, I see that there heaven lies. And as I look, I see the love of love. Someday they'll see that from the start, my place has been deep in your heart. And in your heart, I see the love of love. Though I've said it all before, I will say it more and more, now that I'm really sure you love me. And I know that from today, I'll say it in the way that you look at me and say, ah, you love me. So let it ring, I'll never care. Deep in your heart, I'll still be there. And when I'm there, I see the love of the love. Though I've said it all before, I will say it more and more, now that I'm really sure you love me. And I know that from today, I'll see it in the way that you look at me and say, how you love me. So let it ring, I'll never care. Deep in your heart, I'll still be there. And when I'm there, I see the love of the loved. I see the love of the loved. I see the love of the loved.
Just to correct George Martin's memory of events, the Beatles were at the Star Club for most of April, all of May, and for the first few days of June 1962. The contract between them and EMI Records was signed on June the 4th, and on the 6th of June, the Beatles travelled direct from Hamburg to the EMI studios in London, which is when they met George Martin for the first time.
They were very offbeat and irreverent. And I like them. I mean, I didn't realise at the time, I knew afterwards, that I had something going for me, because I'd been working on the Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan records, and they were great fans of all those kind of things. So that I was a kind of idol in their eyes before I met them. And they had a very goony kind of humour too, so I was very much attracted to them as people, regardless of what they could do, and I thought we could work together very well.
On June the 6th, the Beatles recorded four songs, none of which was seen as being suitable for release. The songs were Love Me Do, P.S. I Love You, Ask Me Why, and this one.
Bésame mucho. Each time I cling to kiss, I hear music divine. So, bésame. Should leave me, then each little dream will take wings, and my life will be through. Oh, bésame mucho. Oh, love me forever, make all my dreams come true. Oh, this joy is something new. My arms are folding you. Never knew this thrill before. Spring, it's you I adore. Yes, so dearest one, if you should leave me, then each little dream would take wings, and my life would be through. Oh, so bésame, bésame mucho. Yeah, love you forever, make all my dreams come true. Joy is something new. My
is the thrill before. Whoever thought I'd be holding you close to me, whispering, it's you I adore. Oh, so dearest one, if you should leave me, then each little dream will take wings and my life will be through. Oh, so bésame, bésame mucho, and I'll love you forever, make all my dreams come true. Oh, love you forever, make all my dreams come true. Oh, love you forever, make all my dreams come true.
That first recording session at EMI was not a great success, and they would not be back there until September. However, a big welcome home celebration had been planned in Liverpool by their fan club, and on June the 9th, attendance records were broken at the Cavern as over 900 people crammed themselves into that sweaty hole in the ground. Coming up next, The Beatles, live at the Cavern. It's the summer of 1962, and by now Brian Epstein's influence was being felt in many ways.
I encouraged them at first to get out of leather jackets and jeans, and that I wouldn't allow them to appear in jeans. After a short time, and then after that step I got them to wear, I think, sweaters on stage, and then very reluctantly, eventually suits. I think it was for their one of their first sort of major appearances. I'm not sure that they didn't wear their first suits for a BBC broadcast to a live audience.
Okay, this is it. The Beatles sing Some Other Girl.
To the Cavern, which is unbelievable. Dirty, dingy. It's actually was an air raid shelter during the Second World War, and used as a cellar for a furniture company, I understand, a storage area. And it's just unbelievable. It's got that musty kind of smell to it, and about four red light bulbs that illuminate the place, and you don't illuminate that place. It's just so dark and dingy and dirty. Bob Wooler, I think, is the general manager there, and he started out as the DJ at the place, and he says he introduced the Beatles, I think, 295 times, and not once were they ever rushed on stage.
My best playing days were at the Cavern, lunchtime sessions. Those to me were like the best playing days ever I had, where we just go on stage with a cheese roll and a Coke and a ciggy. and a few requests, you know, and you just sing them in between eating your cheese roll, you know, and no one minded, and it was cool, and that, and you enjoyed it, and then you went afterwards and had a drink. Mm. You know, and that was great to me. I felt like we really got something going in that place, in the cavern. I mean, we really got a rapport we never got again with an audience at that place.
And that version of Some Other Guy you heard just now was recorded at the Cavern on August the 22nd, 1962, just 4 days after drummer Pete Best was sacked.
What had happened is the Tuesday night we'd been playing at the Cavern Club in Liverpool. And at the end of the session, Brian came up to me and said, Pete, I'd like to see you in the office the next morning. Now, this made no shakes to me, simply because of the fact, okay, prior to Brian taking over as being manager, I'd sort of run the business side of the group. I'd been taking the bookings, etc. And we used to get called into the office quite regularly, discuss, you know, is it worthwhile going back to this venue, or should we put the price up, you know, things like that. Sort of getting a little bit of advice. Met him, he took me upstairs to his office, and he turned around and sort of, I could tell he was on edge, because, okay, he was always sort of timid in his approach, you know, he was a little bit nervous and shy about what, you know, the way he talked to me. But I could tell that he was very edgy. And he sort of talked round the subject, made little chit-chat here and there, till he eventually settled himself down. And he turned around and said, Pete, I've got bad news for you. So I, you know, didn't expect anything. I thought possibly, you know, he hadn't been able to get a venue or something like this. So I said, you know, what is it? And he said, you're out. You know, the boys want you out, and they want Ringo in.
Well, I've been playing with groups now since about 1960, you know, just playing, getting money, you know, working. And I met the Beatles in Germany when I was there with another group, and we used to have to work 12 hours between the two groups, you know, and we got to know each other pretty well. And we all came back to England, and their drummer was sick, so they asked me would I sit in, you know, just for a day or so till he got better. And I said, yeah. And then I did that, and then I went with another group again, you know, and they got him back. And then he was sick again, and they came and asked me, you know. So every time he was sick, they just used to come and ask me to sit in, which I used to love it, you know, because they were a much better group than the one I was with. And then we had this job at a holiday camp in England where, you know, you play for 3 months, which is supposed to be the season, but there's never very much sun. And Brian Epstein phoned me up and said, would you like to join the Beatles, you know? He said, well, he phoned me up on a Tuesday and said, would you join the Beatles? I said, yeah. He said, well, can you get home tonight? And I said, I can't leave the other group just like that, you know. Must give a bit of notice. So I said, I'll be there Saturday. And then I arrived Saturday. We had about 2 hours rehearsal, and then we played that night, and we've been playing ever since. This was in August 1962. So loud.
On August the 23rd, John Lennon married Cynthia Powell in Liverpool. And on September the 4th, John, Paul, George and Ringo returned to the EMI studios in London. What happened this time is coming next.
Love me do, whoa, love me do.
Love, love me do, you know I love you. I'll always be true, so please.
Love me do.
September the 4th, 1962, EMI's Abbey Road Studios and the Beatles record two songs that day, an original, Love Me Do, and a song found for them by George Martin, How Do You Do It? On the 11th of September, they went back for another session, re-recording Love Me Do with a session drummer, recording the first slow version of Please Please Me, and the song that was to be the B-side of the first single, P.S. I Love You.
As I write this letter, send my love to you.
Send my love to you.
October the 5th, Love Me Do and P.S. I Love You were released in Britain, and that other song that George Martin had found for them stayed on the shelf.
This was one thing about George Martin. Talking to him nowadays, I can get the background story from his point of view, which we never knew then. It turned out that they tended to throw him stuff nobody else really wanted. He got all the sort of comedy, and he was a little bit the light end of the record label he was on. So with us, I think we'd just been steered his way because no one else would have us. And he thought there was something quite interesting there, but he didn't really like our early songs. He was right, too. You know, Love Me Do was... But he let us make it as a record. But at first he suggested some real songs written by real songwriters, you know, the people who were working professionally in Charing Cross, down Charing Cross, and Tim Pan Alley people. And he brought a song called How Do You Do It, which was later a hit for Jerry and the Pacemakers. And George had a big thing about this song, and he said, it's going to be a hit, so it's just a question of whether you want to do it or not. And we said, we really don't want to do this. And he said, well, but just try it. You know? So we went away and rehearsed it and did a demo of it, which is quite good, actually. You know, it's, if you hear it now, it's not that bad. But we just said, no, we've really got a feeling, you know, we don't want to use other people's stuff. We really want to try and write our own stuff. So after much hooing and hawing, he let us do our own record, which was a minor hit. I think it got in the top 20. Mm. So that was really the big start of it all.
Right.
And then George got us a bit more together after that, and we began to write a bit better stuff, I think.
How do you do what you do to me? I wish I knew. If I knew how you do it to me, I'd do it to you. How do you do what you do to me? I'm feeling blue. Wish I knew how you do it to me, but I have no clue. You give me a feeling in my heart, ooh la la, like an arrow passing through it. Suppose that you think you're very smart, but won't you tell me how do you do it? How do you do what you do to me? I wish I knew. If I knew how you do it to me, I'd do it to you. You give me a feeling in my heart, ooh la la, like an arrow passing through it. That you think you're very smart, but won't you tell me how do you do it? How do you do what you do to me? I wish I knew. Wish I knew how you do it to me, but I have no clue. Wish I knew how you do it to me, I do it to you. Wish I knew how you do it to me, I do it to you.
The Beatles and their unreleased How Do You Do It. On October the 27th, Love Me Do entered the Melody Maker singles chart at number 48, due mainly to heavy sales around the Liverpool area. And on the 31st, they flew to Hamburg for their fourth visit.
I think if you work it out, sometimes we used to play about an 8-hour day. We'd actually play 8 hours. But at the time, it wasted us and totally kind of wrecked us. And I remember getting home to England, my dad really thought I was half dead, you know, must look like a skeleton. But I hadn't noticed the change. I was just having such a ball, you know, staying up late and everything and all that for a young kid. In Hamburg, when we first arrived, we were, you know, very green bunch. And there was the manager, though they called him the Geschäftsführer, over there. And he was a fellow called Willy. And he used to say to us, Max Schau, you mean, make show, do something. We should just stand there and go through the tunes. We've been enough in Liverpool. But in Hamburg, the thing we had to do was people would come to the door of the club, and they'd just poke their head in and sort of look at the beer prices. And then they'd see a band vaguely there, so we'd have to go, woohee, hey, and look at us, you know, come on in. And so it was really good for us, actually, good training, pulling power. So immediately anyone appeared and put their head around the door, we'd Max Schau.
Thank you.
I knew, as soon as I signed them, that I had a potential hit group. My main worry was the material, because I was very... it was obvious to me that they weren't writing hit songs at that stage. And I was looking around desperately for songs to give them. I did that, actually. I found a song which I thought was a number one hit, made them record it, and they didn't want to, but they did. And then they came to me and said, well, look, we like this song, but we'd rather have our own one. Please Please Me was the one that they brought to me as an answer to the song that I'd given them, which was How Do You Do It? And I said, all right, we'll have a go at recording it. And he records it, number two studio Abbey Road. And when we finished the recording, I did actually go down in history by saying, you've made your first number one record, I promise you. And they all clapped their hands, clapped each other on the back and said, yippee, not really believing it, but of course it was. It was the beginning of a long line of number one.
I liked them enormously. I immediately liked the sound that I heard. I heard their sound before I met them.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually that's important, because I think that it should always be remembered that in fact people hear their sound and like their sound before they meet them. They are important. But I immediately liked what I heard, and I thought that it was something that an awful lot of people would like. They were fresh and they were honest, and they had what I thought was a sort of presence, and this is a terrible vague term, star quality. Whatever that is, they had it. Or I sense that they had it.
That's Brian Epstein. On November the 16th, 1962, they came back from Hamburg, and on the 26th, re-recorded Please Please Me, this time making a fast version on the advice of George Martin. On December 15th, having won the Merseybeat newspaper poll once again, the Beatles appeared at a special Merseybeat Awards night at the Majestic in Birkenhead. And on the 17th, they left for their fifth and final visit to Hamburg, playing their last show there on December the 31st, 1962. We'll be right back. Coming next, 1963, the year it all went mad.
Right about now, I would like to bring on somebody for you. Want to tell you that, ask you to help me make this introduction. I'd like to say a name, and I'd like you to repeat the name. And then when we get through, we'll all add it up, and it ought to have some fun for you. Are you ready? Let me say it first. You repeat it after me. John!
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, a history of the Beatle years 1962 to 1970. I'm Roger Scott in London. It's 1963.
In the early days, you know, this is, say, about 4 or 5 years ago, we were influenced by the early Elvis records and Carl Perkins and Chuck Berry and, you know, Little Richard. All those, you know, we used to like all that sort of stuff. And Buddy Holly. But, you know, there's not one person that we've sort of tried to copy.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
January the 1st, 1963, the Beatles arrived back in Liverpool from their final Hamburg visits, and the following day began a 5-night tour of Scotland. Whilst they were there, Love Me Do rose to number 21 on the Melody Maker singles chart, its highest position, and on the 11th, their next single was released in Britain.
Last night I said these words to my girl.
On the 19th of January, the Beatles were seen on national television for the first time, singing Please Please Me on a show called Thank Your Lucky Stars. VJ Records signed the Beatles for America on the 25th, and on February the 2nd, they began their first nationwide tour of the UK. Top of the bill on that tour was 16-year-old Helen Shapiro.
Well, it was strange. They were the opening act at the beginning of the tour, and you could see the sort of the raw edges gradually being sort of polished over, and how they sort of slickened up during the tour. Like, for instance, things about volume and stuff. Because, as far as I know, before they were playing concert halls and cinemas, which is what we were doing, theatres, they'd only done the ballrooms and the clubs in this country and in Germany. So this was their kind of first taste of a real theatre-type gig. And it took them a while to get used to the technical side of things, but they were such great fun, and you could see the audience grow and grow and grow during the tour. They ended up closing the first half, and it was great fun, but of course nobody could foresee how phenomenally big that they were going to be. I mean, we knew they were going to be big, but this it was...
1, 2, 3, 4!
Was just 17, you know,
During a break in that tour with Helen Shapiro, the Beatles spent a day at the Abbey Road Studios, and in that one day recorded their entire first album. In the control room sitting next to George Martin was engineer Norman Smith. It was February the 11th, 1963.
Take five.
From what I can remember about it was a giant tin of throat lozenges was on the piano. I can see it now. Together, strangely enough, with a couple of cartons of Stuyvesant cigarettes and lots of tea being brought up, sandwiches, stuff like that. It was virtually continuous, very hard day. We finished up with Twist and Shout, which John was going to sing. By this time, of course, his voice was practically shot. He could barely speak. So we had to get it in one take. I had to make no mistakes to get it in one take. Otherwise, we would have been without Twist and Shout, possibly, on that LP. Anyhow, couple more throat lozenges, couple more cigarettes, and we did. We got it in one take.
Please Me album was recorded in a day because A, the Beatles knew all the songs inside out, having been playing them on stage for some time, and also because the recording equipment of the time was so primitive. Whereas today a modern studio will have up to 32 tracks to work with, all the Beatles recordings for the first year were done two-track.
Two-track stereo recording. What we had to do was to record the backing, first of all, or for that matter, it could have been a full vocal track as well. And if we wanted any overdub, what we had to do was to send that tape from a stereo machine onto another stereo machine, adding whatever one wanted to add on to that particular recording of the second machine. Now, this meant, of course, that one would finish up with a sort of a pseudo stereo and not have a nice picture, you know, from left right the way round to right. One would only have extreme left or extreme right.
You'll never know how much I really love you. You'll never know how much I really care. Listen, do
want to know a secret. Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, closer. Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to hear. I'm in love with you. Listen. Do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, closer. Secret for a week or two. Nobody knows, just we two. Listen, do-da-do. Do you want to know a secret? Do-da-do. Do you promise not to tell? Do-da-do. Closer. Do-da-do. Let me whisper in your ear. To hear, I'm in love with you. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
I can't get off that.
On February the 22nd, the Beatles' publishing company, Northern Songs, was formed. And on March the 2nd, Please Please Me was the number one single in the UK. 3 days later, they recorded the follow-up, and on March the 9th, they began a 21-day tour of Britain with Chris Montez and Tommy Rowe. Paul McCartney remembers that tour next.
When we were on the Chris Montez tour, he was top of the bill. It didn't surprise us halfway through the tour when they switched it. They put us top of the bill and him second. It was embarrassing. The hell for him, you know, what could you say to him? Sorry, Chris.
Right.
You know, and he took it well and stuff, but it was embarrassing. But we expected it by then. Mm-hmm. We'd seen that everywhere we'd gone seemed to work. And another thing we thought was that, like, all the old-time vaudeville performers were all saying, the trouble with today's entertainers is they've got no background. But we did. We always thought we had this ace up our sleeve of having this hard background in Hamburg. Or I did, anyway. I think the others felt similarly, you know, that... Here we were, we'd actually had done this grounding these old vaudevillians were talking about.
Whilst they were on the road with Chris Montez, the Please Please Me album was released on March 22nd. John Lennon's son Julian was born on April the 8th in Liverpool, and on April the 12th, the new single, From Me to You, was released.
What is it, this Mersey beat, this Liverpool sound? What has it got?
I don't know! It's got something you can't explain, it's just there! It's got something that nobody else has got!
Is there anybody here from Liverpool?
No!
It's the bass guitar and bass drum combined together.
Why do you like the Beatles?
When we started off with the Beatles, John and I sat down to write some songs. We wrote about the first 50 or so, out of which I think Love Me Do is the only one ever got published. The rest just vanished in the mists of time. The thing at the time we were trying to do, which made those songs not very good, was one of the things, we were trying to find the next beat. They were talking about rock calypso. You know, Latin rock is going to be the next. And we used to sit around there thinking, now, what's going to be the next beat? And we'd write. And when the minute we stopped trying to find that next beat, the newspaper said, it's Mersey beat. And we found that we'd discovered the next beat without even trying to discover it.
When From Me to You came out, the NME said, below par Beatles. So that was about the third or fourth single, and we were already finished. You know, we're already not good enough.
From Me to You hit number one on May the 4th, the same week that Please Please Me became the number one album, and it would remain number one for 30 consecutive weeks. On May the 18th, it was back on the road, this time with Roy Orbison.
We'd like to sing a song called From Me to You. Da da da
da da da. It was nice sort of getting out on tour again, and the audiences were fantastic, some of them. I mean, some of the crowds had turned out to see us. It was really heartwarming to see them, you know, it was marvellous.
Well, I love it, you know, I love all the kids and all the teenagers and everyone all waiting. It's only, it's funny when you sort of look at them and they think, well, they're waving at us. But we have a good time. Everyone else worries about us if we're having a good time, but we never seem to worry, you know. Believe me, we're having a good time.
Yeah, that's right, actually. All the press are always saying, you know, you must get fed up. You know, going around everywhere is part of our job, and we've just got used to it and got to enjoy it. There's so many girls, but there's usually so many that you've got to dodge them all, otherwise you get battered.
So we end up
you
with
see,
none.
So you don't, so you don't get any. You know, people seem to think that we have thousands of girls every night, but, you know, it's wrong, because we've got to, you know, the police take us off somewhere and shove us in the hotel, and so we only get to see a few girls.
I tried to take 1,000 girls out the other night. It's too expensive,
though. I tried to take 1,000 police.